before we get to the Peirush, and basically we're going to get into a world of discussion here which has got nothing to do with him either, but it's got a lot to do with Jewish history. Gemara Brachos, and I'm just going to read literally two or three lines. That's all you need to know. Tan Rabbanan, famous Gemara, Shimon Pakuli, his dear Yud Ches Brachos, Vithiram Gamil, Allah Seder, the Yavim. Basically, what happened was, after the Churban Abayis, they got the Amida organized, 18 blessings. All right?
After the what?
After the Churban, after the second Churban. Yeah. In Yavne. Yavne became the place instead of Jerusalem, right? Why was it called Yavne? Somebody once said to me, because Yibane. So they had a kind of a Yavne, which is a nice idea in itself. So Yibane, I mean, we sing that Shabbos, so you can think about Yavne. So that's what they did. Amalei Rav Gamliel HaChomim. So Rav Gamliel said to the HaChomim, Chum Yesh Adam Shiedei L'Sakei Brichas HaTzidukim. Is there anyone who knows how to make the blessing of Tzidukim? No, it's not a blessing. Right, it's the first thing. This is the euphemism. Okay, it means here that we're going to have to say something about. Now here it says Tzidukim. Tzidukim are the Sadducees. Now very quickly, what you had in those days, there are two central groups in the Jewish world. The Purushim, which became the Rabbinites, which we would recognize as the Orthodox community. I don't know how you want to describe it. It's hard to put into today's terms. People who respected Tosh Balfour. And then you had the Tzidukim, who basically respected Tosh Balfour. Eventually it became the Karaites, who are still around to this very day. Right, which is quite amazing. There are Karaite communities. I just heard about, there's a couple in Israel that are still on. And I just heard about one in England, which I was really shocked about. North of England, there's a Karaite community, which is pretty amazing. There were many in Russia. Interesting how it spread to Russia. So there's a whole historical shtick here about with the Karaites, how they developed. There is a very interesting story. I'm just preempt the whole thing with the story. But anyway. And the story goes like this. 150 years ago, there was a rabbi called Rabbi Rabinowitz. He was a Polish gentleman who lived in whatever town it was in Poland. And he wrote a letter one day to the Pope. Right? It's a true story. Pope's representative. And the letter to the Pope, good evening. And the letter to the Pope said that he wants to go to the Vatican to copy some manuscripts. Because in the Vatican they've got probably the best library of Jewish manuscripts in the whole world. Alright? Things which have never been seen the day of light. And a miracle took place. This is an unbelievable story. And he was allowed into the Vatican. He was given permission to go in. And he must have spent a couple of years, because I can't believe he could do this overnight, because there's no photocopy machine. Photocopy machine would have been in and out of there in a day. But he had to copy every manuscript by hand. It was a remarkable story. And I don't know if you know this story. And what happened was that he brought out a sefer eventually called Dikduke Sofrim. Dikduke Sofrim is produced usually the size of this Gemara. And it's all the changes in the text which he found between the traditional Vilna text, right, and the original manuscripts which he found in the Vatican. Okay? Just have a break for 2 seconds and I'll just show this to you, because I want to show you the Gemara. It's at the end of the Gemara.
I didn't know you were coming here. I didn't know you were coming here. I didn't know you were looking for him.
Oh, yeah.
I'm sorry.
No. This is just something which is amazing. It's the end of the Vilna Shas, and I'm assuming it's at the end of the Vilna Shas, and it should be here. And if they haven't got it in this one, then we're going to send it back. It's been done. Wait a second. Oh, it's not in here. You can believe it. Basically, the end of the Vilna Shas, if you look at right at the end, Achris Tova. There is a section here called Achris Tova, which basically is an afterword. Right? Now you probably know, I don't know if you've ever seen this, but this is fascinating. And what is it about? It starts off, it says that the people who produced the Vilna Shas, the brothers Rom, the Rom brothers, okay, in fact it was an Almona of Achim Rom, they were the ones who produced the Vilna Shas. And what they did is that they tried to take note of this story about Rabbi Rabinovich. And I'll just read you the quote. He says, what happened was, Ulam, El Mozeinu Shalach Lefenenu Moshiach. In order to try and get the text correct, we had somebody who saved our bacon. Pardon the expression. And who is that gentleman? It's Agon, Moreinu, Rafal, not a Rabinovich. Right? This Rabbi Rabinovich. Shlita. So he was obviously alive. Minchen, he actually was from Munich. I was wrong, he wasn't Polish, he was Yankee. Well, that makes sense, right? Okay. Balmachaba did this open. Asheya of the Kayas Tofresh Samach, that's 1860. He was Baromi, he was in Rome. But Yasomea, and he had a good time. Where did he have a good time? It's unbelievable, it's Lashon. But Bote Okat Hasvarim Shabaromi, the Sifra Dikduke Sofim. Right? And what did he do over there? He had a great time because he was in the library there in Rome, right? To write his Sefer Dikduke Sofim. The Lohayazuchus, he had the merit, Harashus Me'esareya Vatican, La Sos Malachta the base Okara Swarim Asher the Vatican after you may his Gerub. He could even go in when the library was closed. Unbelievable privilege. But after you may a Chagim Akhtanim, even on Sundays, right? But Gam Achachatzah Sayom, because it's closed from midday onwards, which I think is still true today. Lezchus Kazer Lo Zocha Oth Ish Beloda. Nobody besides him ever had the merit. Why did he get the Lezchus? Nobody knows. It was a nice. Kisari Besa Akad Yizharu Ma'od Levli Teit Lichriyah Chok Hazeh. They don't want anybody to come in. Ulam Ha'ish Hazeh Lichbad Ma'od Ba'eni Sari HaVatican. This man was obviously very honorable gentleman in the eyes of the Vatican. He rose Ne'aretz Him Litzu Lifnehem Ba'adam Ve'yofek Ritzon Mehem. Right? They liked him and he liked them, basically. They got on like a house on fire. Ve'hivru Ha'chok Biglalo. They changed the law because of him. Lahara Laharah Shah as a temporary measure, but he owes in that club, exception. Ba Nachnu Hodanu et Sarenu Nachla et Penenu Lazrenu La Chalcenu Mimducho Tenu. Basically, what happened was that the people who produced the Vilna Shas had a big problem. That there was a Warsaw Shas and there was lots of other Shasim, right, produced, which all the texts were not, as you say in Yiddish, they don't shtim, they don't go together, right? So what happened was that they had to get kind of a sort of master version.
The Pope decided.
And the Pope, where do you go for something Jewish? You go back to the Pope. He wears the same hats as we do. So basically, this is the story. And it's an unbelievable story. And the Dikduke Sofrim is really a very special book. You can buy it, you have it to this very day. What is mainly there is all the Gemaras, which are censored. That's really the biggest problem. The problem was that what happened is that the Vatican had a department which was, I forgot now what it's called, it wasn't called the Department of Censorship, but it had some sort of grand name. And they went through every page of Gemara, every line of the Siddur, every line of the Chumash, essentially, every line of the Torah, every commentary, and whenever they found something which they found kind of, how should we say, it didn't meet with their approval, because they thought that we were having some sort of dig at Christianity, they censored it. My favorite is that they always censored the word min. Min means an apikoros. And it's going to be relevant when you'll see what I'm doing with this when we see the brachas. Right? So what did they do? They came across the Gemara brachas, and what they did, instead of the word min, they put the word akum. Because akum is ovek kochav in mazala. Although if you look in the abbreviated, the Rashi Brock in the Rashi Tevis book, it says it's nice. Ovek Christus and Miriam, actually. It's actually referred to Goyim as well. But they didn't know that. But they thought it was ovek kochav. They thought it was pagans, right? So whenever it says min, they would actually substitute the word akum. And they wrote it in. So what do you get? You get the Roy brothers, where it talks about the bracha on cake. So what did they write? Borei Akum Mazonis, which is one of my favorites. True story. They wrote this in. It's really cute. So what are you talking? You know, that was your gospel.
I thought they knew what they were.
They didn't have a clue. All they were looking for is like, you would be reading, let's say it was Chinese, and you were told there were two symbols in Chinese that come together. They didn't have a clue. You want to read about this? It's an amazing story. The guy who writes about this very eloquently is no longer alive, Diane Grunfeld. Grunfeld was died on the London basement. He died in 1976, 77. And he writes in his second volume on the dietary laws, a wonderful book, two volumes, the first book on kashrut, second book on things like Shemitah. And in his section on Shemitah, he talks about censorship. It's fascinating, and he really writes about this whole thing with Rabinovich and the book and so forth. He gives you a whole background to it. The bottom line of all of this is that I go back to this Gemara, and it says Tzakein Berkas Tzidukim, that the Gemara presents it as a blessing against the Sadducees, as essentially a curse against the Sadducees. What the original text in the Duke Sofin, and I haven't seen it inside, but all the information bring it, is that it's actually Birkas Haminim. If you look at the Siddur, you know he gives you a title for every bracha, and you look at the Lamal Shinim, you'll see that it's known as Birkas HaMinim. Now, Minim are clearly different to Tzidukim. Although Tzidukim are a category of Minim, as far as we're concerned, they're heretics, right? In the sense they reject the Torah Shabbat there. But the Minim here, the word Minim is a much broader term than Tzidukim. And therefore, what exactly this is known not as Birkas Tzidukim as it should be over here. Actually, the wording in the Gemara was Birkas HaMinim. It was something which was said against the Minim. Now, who were the Minim? Right? And this is very intrinsic to the whole understanding of this particular bracha.
What else?
Alright? We'll come to this in a second. I'll just tell you what happened. Just to finish the Gemara, and then we'll go into the text. Amar Shmuel HaKlatan. Very famous Gemara. Shmuel HaKlatan got up. He made this bracha. Alright? Now, of course, it's a very strange Gemara. Because what happened was, the Gemara says, the Shana Acheres Shakcha. A year later, in other words, later on in time, it was forgotten, or he forgot it, right? In other words, he didn't remember the nusach of the bracha. So, again, what are we talking about? We're talking clearly about something which was balpeh, wasn't written down, because how can you forget it if it was written down, right? So, again, what was going on over here is that seemingly there is a bracha which was made, which eventually was, it wasn't mainstream, let's put it that way, right? And what happened was, Vihishki Bashtaima Shalashas, what happened was that Shmuel HaKlatan could remember it. He made the bracha and then he forgot it. And therefore he was looking at it, he says, for 2 or 3 hours, below Helu, and they didn't ask him to leave the Omer. But basically, what's going on over here is that it's not really about the Tzedukim. And the meaning that we're referring to here, and they all say this, and you look at Rabbi Schwab's commentary, and you look at the world of prayer commentary, this bracha of Lama Shinim has been changed because originally it was a bracha against the Minim. Who are the Minim? Go back to Shmuel HaKlatan. When did he live? Just after the Churban HaBayis. What was the big danger in Jewish life in those days? The Judeo-Christians. Nowadays, I think you're going to have to call them the Jews for Jesus. The same thing. What were these people? These were people who argued that you could, within Jewish tradition, introduce a concept, or not a concept, but a number of concepts which were very far removed from original Judaism, right? For instance, the idea of a physical God, which is essentially what Christianity tried to sort of bring in. Okay, even though they say they believe in the Ten Commandments, I'm not quite sure how they do that, because they have this idea of a physical representation of God. And all of this stuff, all of this change, or all of this move into Christianity by Jewish groups, and they were Judeo-Christians, no question about it, that became a very big problem after the Churban HaBayis particularly, because they started saying, why was the bias destroyed? Right? Because God rejected the old Israel, we're now the new Israel. And if you think about it, who developed Christianity into Christianity? Right? It was, at that time, it was Paul of Tarsus, Saul of Tarsus, right? Known as Paul. And he was the real sort of mover of Christianity. And essentially, he was the Mishumam. He really broke it away from Judaism completely. But there was a period of time where you had the early followers of Christianity keeping Judaism and Christianity kind of together. They did Hanukkah, they did Kashrus, right? They also did Sundays. I'm not quite sure how you work this all out. It's a kind of, like Jews for Jesus, what they're doing. And it's a terrible problem nowadays, because they're really Muslim. They're a terribly powerful group, and we don't really know enough. We're not saying enough in our communities to do anything about it, because it's a very serious problem. The campuses, it's a major, major problem. And we really need to be more active about it. But there are people working, thank God, working against them. The bottom line of all of this is that essentially, if you go according to the original text of the Gemara, which is why I told you about all the changes in the Dukei Sofer, the Gemara understands that this bracha was added, right, at a later time to the rest of the bracha. What is interesting is that this is not accepted by everybody. This is even before we even get going. I'll tell you where the proof becomes that maybe this bracha existed for a long time previous to the version of the Talmud Bavli, is when you look at what we read last week, except we didn't read it. Some people do this on Purim. There's something called krovitz. I don't know what krovitz means, and I don't even know what the word means. Semrasev, you haven't even got it in the Siddur. It's a special, you may have it earlier, a special tefillah which is said like Yotzeris. Right? For us who do not know what Yotzeris is, some of us know what Yotzeris is, some of us don't. I grew up in a shul which said Yotzeris. It was always 10 minutes, and it was impossible to keep up, always. But those of us who grew up in Yotzeris type shuls, you know what I'm referring to. The Yotzer was always a kind of it's very, very poetic style. Here, Krivitz. It's very poetic style, and it's all about the, a lot of the context of the Shabbos. If it's Shabbos Parah, then the Yotzah is all about the Parah Aduma. The interesting one is Shabbos Agolah, where you've got a lot of dinim of Pesach in the Yotzah. All right, there's a whole section on the Yotzah of Shabbos Agolah, which is really worth reading. They're all worth reading, obviously, but this one has got, halachically, a lot of interesting things. Of Purim, there's something called Krovitz, which is, again, additions which we say in the Amina. Now, interestingly, you'll find on page 795, the bit that I want to look at. If you just open on page 795, you'll see something very strange. You'll see that the way it works is that just before you finish the bracha, you add the extra paragraph.
Yes, 794.
Yeah, it's different page here. 794. Oh, yeah, is it... you haven't got it?
Well, it's...
794.
Right, good. You've got here, if you just turn back, if you want to go back from the beginning there, you'll see it starts much earlier. Krovitz for Purim starts in 788. And what it is that it's like a little paragraph, and then, before you finish the first paragraph of the Amida, and then you do Brachot HaShem again on Ram. Right? Balei Tzadikim. Okay, that's nice. Krovitz. Krovitz. Presumably the guy who invented it, that was his name. I don't know, who knows. It's interesting because we said these in yeshiva. Now, it's one of the few things we did, because we never did yotzos in yeshiva. Yeshivas don't do it. But Krovitz on Purim, for some reason, they did it. And again, I never really found out why.
So what does Krovitz have to do with our discussion?
Now, have a look at page 794, and you'll see something very interesting. The Krovitz of Mishnah Lemitzach HaTzadikim is at the top of the page, right? Then you've got, it says, Chazan continues from Yerushalayim to Lesofa Tochim, the end of that bracha. You've got the Krovitz, and then you've got Bracha Tashem, Bonei Yerushalayim. What about the next one? The Chazan then says, does Et Semach Dovid, and Shema Kolenu. And then, when does he do the Krovitz? At the end of Shema Kolenu. Why doesn't he do the Krovitz at the end of Semach Dovid? Why doesn't he do the Krovitz at the end of Semach Dovid? The answer is suggested that according to this Nusach, or according to this tradition, the bracha of Semach Dovid and Shema Kolenu were actually one bracha. Right? It wasn't two separate brachas. Samach David and Shema Kolenu was one bracha. If that's the case, then you've actually got 17 brachas in the Amida. Where's your 18th bracha? Has to be the Lamashinim. In other words, Lamashinim was not a new invention, but in fact was always there. It had always been there. And they bring a proof in this, because whoever put this together seems to suggest Samach David and Shema Kolenu is one unit. Very interesting. All right? Do you see where I'm going with this? Yeah? And therefore there is a kind of debate. I understand that Yerushalmi is different from the Bavli. The Bavli definitely is of the opinion that Tzemach David and Shema Kolenu are two separate brothers. Why, according to the Bavli, there's no Krovitz for this, I don't know. But I imagine that Krovitz probably wasn't around the time of Yerushalmi, time of the Bavli anyway. This is a later edition. But it's probably pretty old. I mean, this is probably goes back a long way. But that's a question which I can't answer. The Yerushalmi tradition, I would argue, and I think it is based on Yerushalmi, is that Tzemach David and Shema Kolenu was actually one block. Right? How it finished off is that you wouldn't answer Tzemach David, Matzmiah, how does it go at the end? Mitzapani Yeshua, not Mitzapani Yeshua. Mitzapani Yeshua, Brachot HaShem, Matzmiah Keren Yeshua. You wouldn't have the Brachot HaShem at the end. You would have Mitzapani Yeshua, Ushma Kolenu. Or without Mitzapani Yeshua, Kishosa Kibina Kalayom, Ushma Kolenu, Hashem Elokim. Which is very interesting. In other words, one bracha instead of two. But if you count this as one bracha according to that tradition, you're down to 17 brachas, and we know the bottom line is 18. You see, the Gemara in the Gemara Bavli brings all the Ramazim, 18 bones in the back of your vertebrae. All right, it's actually 26 vertebrae, but they were approximate. Okay, they were allowed to be a problem. I'm looking at the book. This is very interesting. But the bottom line of it is that if you learn these two brachas are together, then Lamar Shimon had to have been around to make up the 18th bracha. Right? So to argue that Lamar Shimon is an addition later on doesn't necessarily work according to all opinions. And I find that very interesting.
Don't those people say
it's the Adi one, it's the 19th one. Now, the question I've always had, and this is what Rabbi Schwab explains, is that if it's the 19th one, why do we still call it Shemoneh Esrei? Which is a little bit like, you know, the most frustrating thing.
But the Amida was originally, I mean, Amida was originally talking about the Amida,
yes.
Ezra. Yes. So that was was around 400 years.
Correct. But once we've added a brothel of whichever one you want to say it is, right? Presumably, let's stick with the idea of the Malshinim. Once it becomes a Chaser, as opposed to Shmanasra, why do we keep calling it a Shmanasra? The answer is because one day we want the brothel of La Malshinim to disappear. We don't want to curse out these people. No.
Sure.
Sorry?
Well, I'm sure you're talking about both people.
Yeah, and we know we've got to say it, but one day it will be gone, right? And it's interesting. I'll tell you what is so interesting. Because if you take the historical stage a stage further, you'll realize that the original bracha didn't have the word Malshinim in it. The original bracha, and if you look at the Rishonim, I brought this along just to prove it. The original bracha starts off not La Malshinim, which is actually a new version, but it starts off with, he's got here La Malshinim, it actually starts off with the words Le Meshumodim. Le Meshumodim al Tehi Sikva. For the Meshumodim there should be no hope. Now who are the Meshumodim? That's the early Judeo-Christians, the Meshumas, the guys who left the religion, right? Malshinim is a different concept. And not only that, but if you look in the, I think I mentioned this once, if you look in the Karav Geniza manuscripts, which were found by Schechter 100 years ago, not found by him, but he took them from Cairo, took them to England, they're in Cambridge, and there's still about 50,000 pieces of paper to put together. They've only managed to get through half of them so far in 100 years. There's a lot of work to do in Cambridge if you want to do that stuff. What you'll see there, and I've seen a picture of it, is that the bracha of this bracha of La Malshinim actually had the words at the beginning, Meshumodim v'lanotzrim al tisikvah. It was directed against the Christians. It was really cursing out Christianity. Right? If you say Meshumodim, then you're talking about the Judeo-Christians, the people who left Judaism, and the Notzrim are the Vadai Christians, right? Whichever way you understand it, the bracha here was, and of course it had to be changed over the years, because they didn't like it, right? The non-Jews knew that we were doing it. And again, if you read what Rabbi Schwab writes and what Eli Munch writes, they say that this became a real bone of contention against the Jewish community. The Jewish community was so criticized by the non-Jewish community, by the Christian community, for saying this blessing. Even though it wasn't really, if you ignore the Notzerim bit, but you just say it only was Meshumodim, you could argue it was only for the early Judeo-Christians, the ones who left Judaism to become Christians. Once Christianity got established, maybe it wasn't referring to those guys so much. Right? We'll see. There are other interpretations of who actually refers to. What it means is, sorry, just one second. What it means is that over a period of time, the word Malshinim is clearly not the original wording of the Bible. With all of that introduction, that's really what I wanted to get to. But the word La Malshinim, which we say, the word that we use, is not the original wording. It was either Meshumodim, praying to the Judeo-Christians, or it could have been Notzrim, or it could have been Minim, which are also, right, the heretics, which would have been referring to the same group. But who does it not refer to? The Malshinim. Still keeps the word minim. Malshinim v'na minim. Al-T-Sik. Kolaminim. Kolaminim created to me. Right, right. And the word minim is sort of there. And again, what exactly the word minim refers to? You can keep it within a Jewish context if you want. Okay, people who have rejected the basic fundamentals of Jewish belief. But what is clearly historical about this bracha is that it had this overtone towards Christianity. What is so interesting historically is that the wording, a suggestion why the wording was changed is because it was a successful bracha. Because the real Meshumodim, the Judeo-Christians, disappeared. Right? They're not around. Well, apart from the Jews for Jesus, they've come up again, which is very interesting. But they basically, for 2,000 years, they disappeared. Because how long did Judeo-Christianity survive? A very short period of time. Because it melted into regular Christianity. So you don't get Christians who keep Shabbos and Sunday. You don't get Christians who have bris milah. All right? That could go the opposite. They don't keep kosher, they don't keep Shabbos. Well, we do. So the whole bracha was very successful. It really destroyed them, right? It really got rid of them. So eventually the suggestion is that it was changed, right? Because it kind of became redundant for itself. It wasn't necessary to curse those people anymore because they weren't around anymore, right? So there's nobody left to sort of put this particular, direct this particular venom towards. Whichever way you understand it, the point that I wanted to make, the first point of introduction is that Malshinim is not the original wording of the bracha. How did the word Malshinim come in? Whatever a Malshin is, right? Whatever that is. It came in because, essentially, of Christian censorship. And you're going to say, you're going to ask the question.
No, it just says here where they got the...
Oh, the COVID. Yeah, they pointed that out. What is it, Kat? Colerino, I'm sure.
Well,
it's a big event. I like that. A very short word on Christian censorship, because that's something that we need to be aware of. If you just turn the famous thing as Elena, and if you turn to page 158, we're jumping around the SID of this evening, but it's very interesting to sort of, this evening, before we get into the motion, we need to know some historical stuff. Okay, who the bracha was originally directed at? Was it part of the original 18 brachas, or was it a 19th bracha, which is already a machlokas, that's already we've just been speaking about? And the whole concept of if it was changed, who had the permission, who had the right to change it? So if you look at page 158, you'll see over here that there is this famous phrase in the Olena, after the third line, Shalosh Samcha Keno Kohen V'Gor Olena Kuchal Amonam. And then in parentheses, which in the Sidur Rinat Yisrael is not in parentheses, and in most of the newest Sidurim is not in parentheses, Shehei Mishtachavim Lehevo Zerik, is that they pray to Hevo Zerik, and the Babichas always spit at this point, if you've ever noticed that, because Rik is the same word as Rik, meaning spit, so they all spit on the floor. But the Babish doesn't have, the Nusachari doesn't have the next bit. Umispalalem El El La Yoshir. They daven to a God who is not going to save them. So of course, what did the Goyim say when they saw this phrase? Yoshir, the same word as Yeshu. Yeshu, Yimachshem Ur Zikro, referring to what they now call Yehoshua, right? They made him kosher. But basically referring to JC, Jesus. And the Goyim came along, the censors came along and said, you can't say that. Because you're saying that our God is Lo Yoshir. He's not going to save us. And we know that the basic rule is Moses invests, Jesus saves. You know this famous idea, right? And this is basically the difference. The Elder Yeshia was very, they didn't like it. So what did they do? They put a line through the whole thing. I saw a manuscript in London, which the way they censored it was they used very heavy ink. They literally would take a manuscript and they would literally spill ink all over it. And after 500 or 600 years, that ink is beginning to come up, it's beginning to rub out. And it's fascinating. What we see underneath is the original text. And you're beginning to, the manuscripts are still there. The original manuscript was written in very, permanent ink. But the censoring was done using very poor ink in comparison. And this phrase clearly is now being reintroduced, and I think really should be reintroduced in every siddur. The Art School made a compromise over here, certainly in the early Art School siddurim, and put it into brackets. Whether this is going to change over a course of time, I don't know what they've done in the new siddurim, you know, the line-by-line ones and stuff like that. Whether it's still there in brackets, I think to be politically correct, they're going to keep it like that. Just in case anyone complains, they'll say, well, it's in parentheses, so we're not being too controversial about it. You want to say it, you say it. You don't want to say it, you don't want to say it. Well, that's the point. I don't know, the traditionalists, all right? The people who don't like to say this. Jews are going to complain. Why are Jews going to complain? Because, we've been saying it like the way we've saying it in the last, 500 years. Why should we change? And as I said, Chabad kind of do a strange compromise. They do the Hevel Rig, and then they stop there. They don't do the El Yashir bit. So maybe they kind of, the Sahari got rid of it anyway, because the objectional phrase is more the El Yashir. What is very interesting is that you look at the context, and it must be there. Think of how it works. If we don't have that phrase, what does it say? Shalosh Samcha Keno Kohen V'Gor Olenu Kuchal Amonam. We're not like them.
There should be no
V'Anachnu. And we, V'Anachnu Karim. But it doesn't say what they do. Right? So it says, and we bow down, implying, we're contrasting what we do to what they do, but it doesn't say what they do. If you have Shehei Mishtachavim, have a Merit, then I know what they do. They bow down to something which is empty. V'anachnu, we bow down to something which is Kodesh Baruch, we bow down to God. So that makes sense if the phrase is actually put back in, right? Just to prove the point. The whole concept of censorship is unbelievable. What they did, as I said at the beginning, my favorite is the Bari Akum Mazonis. That's a classic. There are a whole bunch of things like that where they really did this mindless censorship. I'll tell you one which is phenomenal. And I saw this manuscript, and it's a famous phrase. You'll all know it because you've seen Schindler's List. What does it say at the beginning there? Kala Matzo Nefesh Achas. Finish the phrase. Right? Now you look at the original manuscript of that Gemara. It's a Gemara in Sanhedrin. You know what's missing? You know what word is missing? You'll be shocked. The word Yisrael is missing. Kala Matzel Nefesh Achas, Kinu Kiyam Olam Malet. Meaning, as long as you save human life, doesn't matter whether it's a Jew, a guy, a Muslim, who cares who it is? It's a Tzelem Elokim. You're saving the whole world. Why did they put Yisrael into it? Because after all the persecution during the Middle Ages, they couldn't stand the concept of saying something which would say, if you save a guy, it's as if you are saving the whole world. They couldn't stand that. So they had to put in Nefesh Achas Yisrael. Fascinating. That's a reverse censorship. We changed the text. I saw this because the text that I saw was an original text from about 1300 without the Yisrael bit. So it's been changed since then. So maybe it was to do with the Spanish expulsion. I really don't know. I was sitting with a scholar in London who was showing me all this. He blew my mind on this. This was something, because he shows you the manuscript. These are the manuscripts which you can pick up at Sotheby's in New York at the moment, because the college in London, a ring around is being closed, and they're selling off all these manuscripts. You've got to spend $1 million, you can buy some of these manuscripts. They're selling them off at Sotheby's. There was a big auction about 3 months ago. They shouldn't be selling it. It's too precious. And it's going to sit in somebody's vault because somebody's got $1 million to spare and it'll never be seen again. And that's the charge. It's like buying it at Picasso, gets sold and you never ever see it after that because it sits in somebody's vault. The reality is that all of these types of manuscripts where there's been changes, most of the changes have been to scrub things out, to erase, or at least to blot them out. They put ink all over them. Occasionally, we have also changed the text, which is interesting. All right? And again, a lot of it is to do with historical reasons. Okay? My favorite, again, another one of my favorites is in benching. Why do we do Magdil during the week and Migdal on Shabbos? Right? Why do we do that? So we say, because it says in the instruction in benching, if you look at the benching, this is unbelievable. All of these things are...
That was printed.
Yeah. And again, a lot to do with changes, which have got nothing to do with reality, but to do with somebody's imagination. If you have a look at Magdala Migda, page 194, the English instruction is on the Sabbath festivals of Rosh Chodesh. Right? Well, the original instruction was abbreviation, Bet, Shin, Bet, Beis, Shin, Beis. All right? So the printer thought Beis, Shin, Beis was an instruction for Shabbos. Okay, so what did you do? He saw Magdil, and then it says Migdal in parentheses. They thought, Shabbos, you changed from Magdil to Migdal. What does Bet Shin Bet really mean? For Shmuel Beis. Because if you look in Shmuel Beis, you'll find that the change in the text was Magdil to Migdal. So what happened is that it gets so absurd that even the printer has had a tremendous effect on text. So you've either got to worry about the censor, you've either got to worry about somebody who had it in for the going somewhere along the line, and the third thing, which is the most difficult one, is the printer. Right? Then what do? You go to Yeshiva, Pamela and Svat, and you start learning Rambam. And you find that there's a steer in the Rambam between what the Rambam says in Hilchos this, and what the Rambam says in Hilchos that, and then you go to Reb Chaim, and then you go to the Brisker of here, and you go to this one there. What do? You go to Reb Kapach's Rambam, the original Yemenite Rambam, and you find that the whole text is not what it was. It's changed. In other words, what have we got? We've got a printer's version. And so much of the Londis in Lithuania, right, is based on some of these texts which are above and beyond the Lyra, right? And we did intellectual somersaults to try and line up the contradiction that it wasn't a contradiction. When the reality is it was never a contradiction because the text was not really
Badu. Same thing in the number of places with Rashi.
And there's issues with Rashi, and there's sometimes we were so worried about Rashi's commentary that we actually reject them. And the Dorian, we do the Ram, we don't do Rashi, in case it wasn't Rashi at all. This is a whole world of discussion. To bring it back to what we're doing, we have to understand that the word Lamalshinim is an absolute casualty, right, of this syndrome. Whether it was the censor, whether it was the printer, whether it was somebody who came along from the Jewish community and changed it, for whatever reason, this is not the original version of the bracha that we say. Lamalshinim is not what was originally said. Right? Either it was the word Laminim, or more likely that we've got over here from the Reba Yakar, which is a Rishon, it's the word Mishumodim. Again, in his day, maybe the word Mishumodim was still relevant because there were people who were leaving Judaism, they were going to Christianity. All right, you had issues in Spain, okay, with a lot of people who did give in. not everybody could withstand the pressures of conversion. Whether that refers to the Maranas, I don't know. I don't think they would be called Mishamadim. I don't think so. I'm not sure, right? Because that's an interesting question. Whatever way we see this, whatever way we understand this, this is a very, very fascinating bracha, right? Historically, this is without understanding one word of what it's talking about. The reality is that the bracha historically is really, really challenging, right? Once we sort of overcome that particular introduction and we understand where we are, let's try and make head or tail of what we're doing now with the bracha as it stands today. Okay, because once you understand the historical background, then maybe we can go a bit further and we can look at the current situation and what exactly it's referring to. And that's where I go to the Rav Avraham ben Agra. All right? What Rav Avraham ben Agra says, he gives you a very quick introduction to where the bracha comes from, but then he turns around and says that it's got relevance to today as well. Okay? Even if there are not the Mishumodim, or we're not really talking about the meaning. And in our Nusach Ashkenaz, there is no mention of the meaning. Okay? There's no mention of the Mishumodim. Even in Nusach Sfarad, you don't mention the Mishumodim. Nusach Sfaradi, the Eidot HaMizrach, I'm not sure. I'm not sure what they do in the Arab or the original Spanish meaning. But it doesn't mention Mishumodim. No. All right. Whatever it is, let's just see, and we'll start this, and if we'll get through this, let's see what the Rav Avraham ben Agra does with all this. And again, this is fascinating. I mean, it, one day, pick up a lecture on censorship. You know, all the different types of censorship, and you'll see stuff, and it will blow your mind. There's no question about it. And there's a lot of information there, a lot which has affected us. Just one final comment on that is the ultimate paradox is that where do we get chapter and verse from? How do I know this is Bereishis chapter 32 verse 1? Right? You won't find that in Rashi. You won't find that in the Gemara. Where do we get it from? Who was the guy? What was the non-Jewish guy who did it? Jerome, wasn't it? Somebody called Jerome or something like that? The chapter and verse was actually invented by the non-Jewish world. Kapitel this and pasuk that is not Halig, it's not Jewish. Right? It became, we adopted it, but it's not our tradition. We talk about parasha, that's all we're talking about. Why it happened is because in the Middle Ages, the non-Jews challenged the Jews to disputations, public debates about Christianity and Judaism. And they challenged us from verses, from chapter and verse, and they always used to try and catch us out. So they said, Rabbi, don't you know chapter 32 verse 1 of Bereishis, of Genesis? And the rabbi said, I don't know what you're talking about. You're talking about parashas by Yishlach. Yeah, I know what that is. But I didn't know what chapter and verse is. So because of that, we had to adopt the non-Jewish system. And to this very day, we talk about kapitel, this, and pasuk that, and it's a peleploin that we actually have not gone back to what essentially is the original system, if there was an original system, all right? Which has got nothing to do with chapter and verse, and we still do it. And I can't explain it to you, I don't know why. Right? You would think to yourself, by now we would have, got rid of that system, but we haven't. I suppose it became convenient. Chapter and verse was just too easy to discuss, I don't know. All right. Anyway, that's
so.
Again,
why is Russian
of Oyvecha instead of Oyvenu? We'll come to. We'll see at the end. He talks about the difference between an Oyev and a.
We have to worry about God's enemies. They take care of himself.
We'll see who it's referring to. It's right at the end. Just bear with me on this. But Lama Shini, he starts off like this. Hu Birkas Amini. All right, the blessing, and again, the word blessing in as a euphemism here, right? For the meaning, for the heritage. Shetikna Shmuel HaKotan B'Yavne, which Shmuel HaKotan made in Yavne. We saw the Gemara in Brachas, and all the various historical background which I wanted to sort of make clear to you. And the Tikna Seder HaKosuv Sha'om Shalom HaMelech Alav HaShalom. Now this is interesting. His suggestion is that this whole bracha actually is based on a pasuk of Shlomo HaMelech in Mishlei. All right. Now that, if you think about it, would support the concept that the bracha was around a very long time ago. Okay, maybe older than we suspect, and it may very well be one of the original 18. Right? Because if we're going back to Shlomo HaMelech and Mishlei and say that this bracha depends on that, then it can very well be that was the original bracha. And Tzemach David and Shema Kaleinu went together, which is what we saw from the Krovitz of Purim. Alright? So, again, I'm just speculating on that particular point, but that's an interesting error, I think. So he says, what does he say in Mishlei? This is, a typical type of Shlomo HaMelech bracha. Nobody really knows what he's talking about. Adam b'liyal ish oven Holech Ikshus Peh, right? The man who is Belial, which means without a yoke, godless. Ish Oven, the man of iniquity or whatever. Holech Ikshus Peh goes with a trap in his mouth. Ikshus Peh, or with action is also the other possibility. Action here means without a muzzle in this case. He's stubborn. He goes with the stubbornness of the man. All right, we'll see what this is referring to. The next pasuk there goes on, he gives the whole quote. Koreitz be'enov molel b'rav. What does he do? He kind of squints his eyes as a kind of sign because he's an ish belial, he's a godless man. So he doesn't show approval. He sort of, makes a face. Molel b'raglov, or he sort of kind of shuffles his feet. Moreh be'etzbosav, or he waves his fingers around. Again, all of this is signs of disapproval. And the third pasuk over there, Tapuchos belibo cheresh ra b'chol eis medonim yishlach. Right? The tapuchos belibo, the revolutions, the turning round in his heart, cheresh ra, right, is bad. Cheresh means that he doesn't hear. Cheresh means he's a cheresh, means he's deaf. Doesn't hear. B'chol eis medonim yishlach. At all times he sends medonim. Medonim means gifts. This pasuk doesn't make any sense to me whatsoever. Right? So don't worry about it. I don't know what's going on over here. Al-Kain, and the pasuk finishes off, therefore, pitom yavo edom. His day will come. Eid means his day of his celebration, right? Because they're talking about the Gemara Avodah Zarah, the Yom Ha'Eid, yeah, the Lifnei Eidim. And Peta Yishbo Yishover Ve'ein Marpe, right? He will be broken and there's no one to heal him. Peta means Lashon Pitom, probably suddenly.
In this context, Eido is his destruction.
His destruction, not his celebration, but his destruction.
Right.
Now, what is all this all about? Says the Rabbi Avraham Ben Agro, and he understood these psukim, right? Thank God. He goes like this: Pasuk Rishon Kolu B'Milas Malshini. This pasuk, the first pasuk that we just read, because there's three psukim in that section, and it goes up to the word Ikshus Peh. That is what Malshinim refers to. And as far as the Rabbi Avraham Ben Agro is concerned, it refers to Jews. In the modern context, I know we said it originally was made about Judea Christians, or it might have been made about heretics or whatever. Nowadays, unfortunately, it refers to people from amongst us. Who is it referring to? Shehem Ra'im, they are evil. She'enam Mekablim Ol Machut Shamay. Very difficult concept. People who do not accept the yoke of heaven. Now I think here we've got to start thinking about not people who do not know about the yoke of heaven, because that covers the vast majority of people. They just haven't been educated. Here we're talking about people who maybe know about it but don't accept it. Okay, so that is the classic Apikoros. How many Apikoros are in the world today? I know of one in England that I can call an Apikoros. Because to be an Apikoros, you've got to be a Talmud Chacham. You have to learn Shas to be an Apikoros. It's not easy to be an Apikoros. You've got to qualify in a university to be an Apikoros.
Yes, of course.
I think JTS probably had a couple of them, who might have admitted themselves. But they were classic examples of it. But in England, there was only one who's still alive, who was going to become chief rabbi. And then they found out in 1964, and he wrote a book 7 years earlier, which was Apikoros. He denies Terumah Shamayim. Right? And at the last minute, he didn't get the job. Unbelievable story. They were going to give him the job, and then they read this book, which was tucked away in the library somewhere. Nobody knew about it. Somebody said, how do you make a chief rabbi? A chief rabbi, when he writes things which are against tradition. And they found it out, and that was the end of his candidacy, and that's when Jacobus came from America. And he got the job in 65. And he was the second place, because Herzog, Chaim Herzog, had a younger brother called Yaakov, who got the job, and then died. Got sick, which was really sad. He was a normal man. So that's the whole story. But it's only in England they can discover Apikoros after they appointed the guy. It's unbelievable. Alright, anyway, whichever you understand this, what is it referring to? The guy who's not the Kabbal Ol Machus Shamayim, who miskarev l'rishus, and he's a politician. He wants to get close. He wants to get close to the government. Umidnei she'ein mekarvin ela lahana asan. And they only do this for their benefit. In other words, it's doing it in such a way that he's going to get something out of it. What does this remind me of? During the war, you had these terrible situations where the Nazis forced Jews to be against Jews. Kapos and the Jewish police, right? I'm just teaching about the Warsaw Ghetto at the moment, and the Jewish police were really... Everyone, for one good one, there was one really, really, really bad one. I heard of a story recently in Lakewood that somebody came after the war, was a capo during the war, and came to Lakewood after the war, and they knew about it. And they ostracized him from the community. Came from an Orthodox shul in Lakewood, and they knew what he did during the war, and he was totally ostracized for years. Right? And so it gives me the chills when I think about it, and it's a very terrible story. So this unfortunately, this thing, it still hangs over. I think the guy's not alive anymore, but it's an unbelievable story. Anyway, again, so you've got these people who want to get close to the rishus, to the people in charge for their own benefit. L'chein hein choshim lahara lezulosan. And the only way to do it is by treading on other people. They do evil to others. L'karev hanar l'rishus. To bring benefit to the people in charge. V'zehu, and this is what is referred to in the pasuk, ish oven choresh ra. He's as it were, he's plowing evil. Right? And then what happens? Achakach holech ikshutzpeh. He then goes and speaks, as it were. Shekol d'rachav holchim el kotev. He goes to an extreme. Shiyakesh piv lahara. He twists his mouth to say evil, lahoros bedibura al iksha zulasa, to start telling about how bad the other guy is. He basically, the word today in the common parlance is that he disses them, if that's the word to use, right? He puts them down, okay? So I'm told from my students. Gamaholchim batom, an even person who goes in sincerity, ya'akesh also, he will ensnare him, he will put him down, lifnei saru moshel, right? The who ba'avur tikvosa, and why do you do that? Because you hope sheyenasu hasan, that he will gain elevation because of it. Putting the other people down for the sake of gain, be it material gain, be it political gain. These are unfortunately recognized individuals like this to this very day. Al kein anachu mispalalim v'lamalshinim al tihi sikva. No hope whatsoever. Ma sheheimu mekavim, that which they hope for. They think they're hoping for greatness, they're going to go down. And that's basically the first phrase. What we're going to do, we're going to hold it here because we're going to go and daven. Next time, Mr. Shem, we'll work our way through the pasuk. And again, just to summarize, what did we see today? We saw the historical introduction to this bracha. We saw that there is a very big issue in Jewish texts. And what I'm touching on today is a very big subject. This is kind of a course in the university to look at all the different examples of censorship. Whether we censored it, whether it was censored by people around us, whether it was censored by the non-Jews, whether it was done by the printer. We've got examples of all these things, right? And really, we need to understand sometimes these things. We need to understand them all the time. Because when we understand that, we begin to get a grip on what the bracha was originally about. And more important for us, what it's become in our generation. Because it's important, but we have to understand what it was originally made for and what it actually became afterwards. And clearly, there has been a revision of this bracha. Right? And it's been revised, and Lama Shinin today has got clearly a different focus to the original focus. What is so interesting, of course, is the original focus and how effective that bracha really was. There's no real Judeo-Christians, at least there hasn't been for 2,000 years, running around. The tragedy is, they're coming up all over again. Unbelievable. Really tragic. Really tragic. We'll come back to Oyvecha next week. Thank you, everybody. Thank you.